and welcome to another edition of Soundography, a crash course in music one band at a time. We're back on doing just single bands, single artists here. And this time around, it's Level 42, a band that started out in the, early 80s. I guess founded maybe in the late 70s, but released their first stuff in the early 80s. And is probably best known for like one or two really popular songs.
I think these guys actually, you're Brian Ibbett and I'm Hammond Chamberlain.
Oh, did I not do that part?
No.
Oh, geez.
That's okay. So
I'm distracted. Do you want to start that over?
No. Sorry. We're good.
Hey, Hammond Chamberlain.
I think that this matches the one-hit wonder a lot better than the Outfield did.
I think so.
Because the outfield skipped along with the top 40. These guys had two.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. I mean, you could argue they had two big hits. And I don't know how big a hit the stuff from Running in the Family was compared to Something About You. That is, you know, that is the big single that everybody probably knows, even though, at least in the UK, Lessons in Love charted higher. Yeah. I remember both of them being very prominent, but I was into the band, so.
And I knew of them. I knew Something About You because it was everywhere. And also, mm-hmm. I remember the video because he was kind of a jerk in the video because a girl kept trying to get in the car and he'd speed up and pull away from her as she kept trying to open the door.
Well, that wasn't him, wasn't it? Somebody else?
Well, yeah, I'm just saying it was just the video. It was just in the video. Right. And I'm like, you know what? If I were her, I'd just stop trying because well, he's a jerk.
Okay. She does after like the second time she like throws her purse down and like, you know, forget it. But I think he does stop again and she gets in and yeah. Everything's all good. No, I remember the video. And again, it's been years since I've seen it. Mark King is kind of like the devilish imp that joins all the stories of the other band members having relationship issues.
He's like the Loki?
He's kind of like the Loki in a really, really bad, goofy, clowny suit with a bowler hat, if I remember correctly. This is all going completely off of memory, and it's easily been 10 years since I've seen the video for Something About You.
That's been longer than that for me. I think it was probably in 87 when I last saw that video. Okay.
And they're in a train for some part of it, and I don't know how much of that is I'm thinking of the Hogwarts Express or you know, maybe he's Dobby, the house elf. That's what Mark King is.
Sure.
Let's talk about some history of the band. The band primary two guys are Mark King and Mike Lindup. However, didn't start out with the two of them. Mark King and Phil and Boone, that's his nickname. Roland is his real name. The brothers played in bands throughout the teenage years. Phil Gould went to a music and art school, and that's where he met keyboardist Mike Lindup. And they had similar musical heroes, Miles Davis, John McLaughlin, Keith Jarrett, and Jan Hammer.
Okay, so the Miles Davis, Jan Hammer tie that's a stretch.
I was going to say that's pretty prominent.
Yeah, it is. It's incredibly prominent. It kind of defines the band because it's lots of jazz and keyboards. But when you put them next to each other, you have famous jazz guy and the guy that did the theme song for Miami Vice.
Right, that's true. Yeah, I don't know what Jan Hammer is. The rest of his library is like. Like, does he have a?
What's he
does
doing?
Does he release
now?
A bunch of? You know, he's got talent. Does he have a whole bunch of albums? Like, does Jan Hammer release albums, and he just also happened to do the Miami Vice theme song?
I have very little Jan Hammer knowledge.
Yeah,
maybe we need to throw him onto a bonus sometime.
There we go. The Jan Hammer Soundography. I love it. When you're listening to Level 42, when you're listening to like Something About You or Lessons in Love, Mark King is the lower voice you're hearing, and Mike Lindup is the higher voice that you're hearing in there. Let's see. Phil Gould and Mark King were part of M for a short time, and that's where they met Wally Badarou.
Okay, they had a hit with they worked on pop music.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Were they part of the band when pop music was?
I think so.
Wow.
Yeah, I think they were. Okay, try some, buy some, be five, oh, five. Talk about pop music, talk about pop music. I want to dedicate it. Pop, pop, shoo-a. Everybody made it. Infiltrate it. Pop, pop, shoo-a. Activate it. music.
That's crazy. I had no idea. I didn't realize they were
Munich, Paris. Everybody, talk about.
Let's see here. I'm curious about the tenure. Oh yeah, Phil Gould was part of the backing band, right? And Wally Badaru was keyboardist. Huh. That's crazy. Dominic Miller was the original guitar player in the band. He went along to play with Sting, and I'm going to bring up Sting later on in the show. Boone Gould replaced him later on.
Okay, the every time I typed in Boone, it was so hard to make sure that was an N and not a B.
Is that, do you type that a lot,
Hammond? My autocorrect. Yeah, autocorrect.
That's funny. A lot of the band were multi-instrumentalists, so the instrumental roles of the band were flexible. So you had some people who could do guitar and keyboards and vocals and keyboards and stuff like that. While they were still instrumental, though, they picked the name Level 42 based on the Hitchhiker's Guide reference, of course, and they set the lineup. Mark King on bass and percussion. The dude is an amazing bass player. You can't argue with that.
No, he really is. He's I think he could be right up there with, like, Jaco and Bunny Burnell and some of these other legendary jazz bass players.
Totally. Yeah, and it's all that slap bass style. Mm-hmm. It's like the do-do-do-do-do-do. Playing with your thumb, I think, is how you do it, like whacking the the strings with your thumb. Mike Lindup was on keyboards and percussion, Boone Gould on guitar and sax, and Phil Gould on drums. I guess Phil can only play the drums. Oh.
I think he could play other things, but I think he was the best drummer of the people who could play the drums.
Sure, right. Yeah, because you notice the other two, Mark King and Mike Lindup, are keys and percussion, or have percussion in their repertoire, but I'll bet it's more like drum programming.
Or like congas and hi-hats. What are they called? The things they bang on your hand and you hold. Tambourines.
Sure. I'm a tambourine specialist. Wally Badaru was never an official member of the band, but he did have writing and playing credits on most of their albums. After a while, the label told them that they needed to have some more vocals in their music, so Mark King and Mike Lindup eventually took on vocal roles. The Gould brothers generally wrote the lyrics, and Badaru and Lindup wrote the music. And very early on, they recorded and released a single called Love Meeting Love and got the band a little bit of attention, but it wasn't until 1981 and a song called Love Games was released and was a dance club hit and a top 40 hit.
Okay. I'll throw this out now.
Sure.
So that we can have the discussion and then my kind of overall thoughts can be known.
Yes.
This band, more than any other we've covered to this point, mm-hmm. I would love to hear them in an era with real instruments or where they didn't rely so heavily on synthesizers, because that sound they have really does date them and really ties them to the era. And I really think it hurts their overall, like, musicality
longevity.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Like, hearing them in the 90s, like in the mid 90s, and I know they did release some stuff in the 90s, but hearing them in, like, the kind of like what we were talking about in 1991, that sound where they were getting away from the overproduced synthesizer stuff of the 80s and saying, all right, and not even just necessarily grunge, but like that whole Gin Blossoms and Goo Goo Dolls and, you know, the bands that came around right around that time that were saying, here's us. Two guitars, drummer, vocals, boom. This is all out there for you. No production wizardry, no keyboards, no synthesizers. Just what you hear is what you get.
Yeah. Kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I really think it dates it. And it just, it was sad because I could hear the musicality behind them. I can see the talent, hear the talent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But after a while, I'm just like, it's all Roland's doing. And
right.
So,
you're not going to say Boone? Not going to call him Boone?
No, Roland, like the keyboard guy.
Oh, the keyboard company. The keyboards, the keyboard company, right? Yeah. Okay.
No.
Roland without a W.
Yes, exactly. The regular spelling, the Americanized spelling.
By the way, I've gotten to see Sparks in concert and just throughout their career in music videos and stuff. And Ron Mayall, the keyboard player for that band, the mostly silent keyboard player with the Hitler mustache and the slick back hair. He has a Roland keyboard, but he has had it custom made by Roland to actually say Ronald.
Oh, nice.
In the same font. Yeah, nice. It's great.
Yeah.
It's really, really cool. All right. So they released Love Games, single Love Games in 1981. They followed that up with a self-titled debut album and quickly established themselves as fan favorites on tour. Not a lot from that album really that bears mention. I mean, Turn It On is a great opener. It's kind of a fun beginning to the band. Because the whole album is very jazz fusion. I mean, it is, if we're looking at the Arnold Palmer ratio for jazz and rock, at this point in their career, it's like 80% jazz, maybe even 90% jazz, 10% rock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it wasn't even rock as much as it was just pop.
Pop. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Love Games also came from this album. Not the Lady Gaga song, but a modest hit for them, if I remember correctly, as well. They followed this up with an album that depends on where you find it. Or I guess originally it was called Strategy, but now when you find it online and in streaming services, it's called The Early Tapes. And it's stuff actually that was recorded before their debut album, before the Level 42 album. Mm-hmm. Boy, it's a hard listen.
Yes.
It's, it's not, there's no hooks or anything. It just feels like, I'll do this bass thing here, and you can do this thing while I'm doing that, and it just is like a very
backgroundy. It's like the Spinal Tap moment where they go, they're going to do the Freeform Jazz Odyssey.
Yes,
it's right, that
the concept album. It totally is. Yeah.
and it's at this point, two or three albums in, where I realized that most of what I'm hearing makes me sound like I'm stuck in an elevator at Dillard's.
Sure. Yeah, true. Well, things turn around for me right at this point. 1982's album, The Pursuit of Accidents. I like this album a lot. I like this new direction for the band. They started adding a little bit more pop. The mix of pop and jazz is starting to get a little bit more, maybe 60-40 jazz, 40% pop. 60 jazz, adding it to that jazz funk sounds. The Chinese Way, a really good song on this album, and turned into a single, did pretty well for the band, as well as the song Weave Your Spell. Also, well, I'll talk about one of the songs on here that I've got on my list. But right here is the point where if somebody was not doing a podcast where they had to listen to the entire catalog of a band, this might be where I'd have them start. I might even have them start with True Colors, the next album. Standing in the Light after this one.
You'd
take him right to World Machine.
I would take him right to World Machine and probably break him off after that.
Oh, come on, you gotta at least have him. I think Running in the Family is it. Well, we'll get to it. Superior album.
Okay, all right.
All right. So after The Pursuit of Accidents is the aforementioned Standing in the Light. It's produced by Larry Dunn and Verdeen White, who were members of Earth, Wind, and Fire.
And that actually has a telling telling sound that carries through the album because of that experience, I think. Yeah.
Yes, without a doubt. And depending on where you look, by the way, both of these albums released in 1983, and depending on where you look, it kind of flip-flops the order on Standing in the Light and True Colors. I think that you could listen to them in either order. I think I prefer True Colors over Standing in the Light. We'll talk about that in a minute.
But it's like Level 42's Use Your Illusion 1 and 2.
It kind of is, right? I mean, we've even talked about other bands that have released two albums in the same year, one at the beginning of the year and one mm-hmm. near the end yeah. of the year. I think the Ramones did that last one, I think I remember us talking about. This one had less of that experimental jazz sound than The Pursuit of Accidents and the things that came before it. That, again, that you could almost see this on a graph with the amount of jazz, the amount of pop, and I guess even the amount of funk almost would be like this constant running through line across the bottom, always with 10% funk.
Yeah. Well, I think with his bass playing style, I think that was just a given. I mean, I don't think that was going yeah. anywhere.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe even more highlighted on this album because of the two guys from Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Yeah.
They also started doing shorter songs. And this was probably something, too, that I expect the label told them. Like, all right, shorter songs, throw more vocals in there, you know, bring the vocals more into the mix, because a lot of those earlier songs had vocals, but they felt drowned out by the instrumentation.
Mm, or afterthought-y.
Or afterthought-y, right, exactly. With that, they got more popularity. It also brought them their first UK hit, a song called "The Sun Goes Down," Living It Up. Do you follow me? I saw just standing in a bar. Looked so tough, he'd come so far. Said I need to love someone before they drop the atom bomb. That Living It Up is the name of a box set later on, and probably a greatest hits. And for the first time ever, a Level 42 album had no instrumental tracks. All the albums before had instrumental tracks on them.
You know, it's funny, the shorter songs equals more popularity. That also went for Metallica.
Sure. Oh, yeah, right.
Because the Black album followed that, and also it didn't have any instrumental tracks on it for the first time.
Right.
There are
right.
a couple bands that I know and love that haven't done that yet. Mm-hmm. And continue to write long, long songs.
People are trying to bring that glass up to their lips, but they haven't quite done it yet.
I'm not saying the name. Everyone knows what I'm talking about, though.
Very good. All right. So they followed that one up with True Colors. This one goes all over the board. There's funk, power pop, mid-tempo rock, some ballads, seven years, really sweet. I'm sorry, 7 days, a really sweet ballad on this. Also, I think a rocker called Hot Water, which would turn out to be another big hit. Kuyate. By the Window, really slow ballad. This, if I didn't start somebody on Standing in the Light or Pursuit of Accidents, without a doubt I would start them on True Colors before I made them dip into World Machine or Running in the Family, because this one I do feel like is a solid album from start to finish.
Okay.
Kansas City Milkman, Chant Has Begun. I'm just looking at the song list and it's like, oh yeah, these are all pretty pretty solid tracks. Chant Has Begun was a hit for them as well, of course. Like I mentioned, Hot Water, that's one you see on all their greatest hits albums. During this time, Mark King also released a solo album.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's all right. And then they released a live album in 1985, right after this, which captured their skills and power as a live band. They were getting people, a lot of fans on tour, because of their energetic performances. I'm sure at least one out of every three songs contained a bass solo.
Oh yeah.
Maybe even more.
So here's the thing is,
sure,
I don't see that energy and power they have as a live band does not translate well into studio recordings. They seem skillful. They seem talented.
I can see that. Yeah.
But there's, whatever there's that probably... energy is they have on stage does not translate well into studio work.
Sure. I think you're right. I think that and by the way, that live album was called A Physical Presence, and it is really good. If you can find it, it's worth listening to. It's funny because it doesn't contain any of the hits that everybody knows them for.
Because a year later, they came out with the one hit that everyone knows them for.
Exactly. but it's still a really solid album. But I think you're right. Like the stuff that they do live, the improvisation in their music, which jazz music is all about improvisation and having their roots in jazz music kind of lends itself to that.
It makes me wonder if they have more fun playing live because they know kind of it's that live setting. And when they're in the studio, they're paying way too much attention to what they're doing because they're also really solid musicians who want to put on the best thing they can on tape.
Right, right. And there might even be something to the fact, I mean, you and I talked before the show, how Mark King, for just what it sounds like from Wikipedia and all music and biographies and stuff like that, it sounds like he's a little bit of a control freak. Like That's he might...
Best way in the world you could have put that.
It's the nicest way to put it, right?
Yeah.
Because I think when you're in the studio, it's a lot easier to say, no, let's do that whole thing again. Let's do this over. Let's do this over. And have a miserable time the whole session. When you're doing it live, obviously, it's one take. And you're forced to just roll with it and build upon it and improvise and all that stuff. And maybe that's why they are such a powerful band on the live albums.
Yeah. It's just whatever it is, they can get it live and I'm not knocking them for their skills, mm-hmm. but it doesn't translate all that well into studio recordings.
Right. Right. Yeah. Kansas City Milkman, the version that they include on Physical Presence is really good. It's a really good live album, a good one to pick up. Next up is the biggie, is the kind of the one that kind of started them on the top 40 track, and that album is World Machine, came out in 1985. More of a mainstream and pop sound. Again, you have your 10% funk, and then above that you've probably got 75% pop and 15% jazz.
Yeah, and I think they're still very much kind of writing on the success of that one song for the next two or three albums because they kind of reference that kind of song over and over again throughout the next few albums.
That phrasing, that pattern, mm-hmm. a little bit. I notice it. I totally notice it with Guaranteed later on in 1991 that the title track might as well be the Something About You template with new stuff stuck onto it.
Yeah, it really. It, yeah, it really feels like they're like, okay, this was a hit. Why? Let's try using it again, but let's change the lyrics and maybe where the breaks are.
Nope, you're not wrong. I mean, even Guaranteed, like I said, begins with that same ooh, mm-hmm. very similar to the stuff that's on Something About You. And of course, Something About You, the big, big single from World Machine. Leaving Me Now also was a hit single for them. Hell was recorded this time?
Oh, okay, there's a... Okay, so in Wikipedia, there was an article about a song called Hell.
Okay.
And it was a track that was not included on the album, and it didn't see any release at all until it was released on Napster in the early 2000s.
Really?
On the original Napster, yeah.
God, I don't even know if I'm familiar with that one.
I wasn't. I just read about it, and I threw it in the notes because I thought it was interesting that Napster actually was one who kind of pooped out that new song.
Interesting. And it's an unreleased instrumental and you can find it on YouTube. Oh yeah. It's really weird and discordant.
It's called Hell.
It is called, and it is Hell.
It's kind of like that song from Eddie and the Cruisers that he was always working on and then died before it was released.
Yeah. It's, listening to it now, and I'm really just kind of sliding over it. It is um Yeah, this would have felt really out of place on World Machine. It feels like something from the early tapes, honestly.
Yeah, okay.
Very, again, discordant, very jazz feeling. I'll have to listen to the rest of that later on. Let's see. Where we go? Oh, Running in the Family, right into it. 1987 saw the release of Running in the Family. This was the album that had the song Lessons in Love, which turned out to be their biggest seller. Also had singles with To Be With You Again, It's Over, and the title track, Running in the Family, which tells a really cute, you know, a really fun story. It was around that time that they played at the Prince's Trust concert in 1987. That was for Prince Charles. I remember that being a big deal as far as that album and all the stuff that was on there. I want to say that that's the first time you ever hear the new version of Howard Jones' No One Is to Blame, the one that's got Phil Collins on on drums, that's very different from the one you hear on Dream It Action. I think it came from that Prince's Trust concert. Eric Clapton was on lead guitar. They played with Benny King, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr as part of that.
So that's an interesting thing, too, is the fact that they're one of those bands that kind of fell off the radar really quickly. They got on quickly and fell off quickly. But here they are performing in 87 with some of the biggest names in rock royalty.
Yeah, well, at the time, they were among them.
I guess they were thinking they were going to have more longevity than they did.
I think it's just the fact that we're hearing about Eric Clapton and Ringo Starr and George Harrison. I think if we look at other people who were part of that same performance, for example, I'm pulling up a set list. All right, here we go. Alison Moyet from Yazoo. Again, you know, same kind of thing where she's great, but you wouldn't put her in the same description as Elton John, Eric Clapton, George Harrison, Ringo Starr.
But I feel like Yaz and Yazoo had a longer track record and better track record than Level 42 did.
Well, it's funny. They only released two albums.
Yeah. Yes, and they have a stronger place in people's consciousness, I think, and in many people's, and in mine at least, than Level 42 does.
Maybe. Yeah. I could see that. I think, it's hard for me to say that just because I'm so familiar with Level 42 that I can't subtract my experience listening to the band in the 80s and say, you know, who was bigger at the time, but Tony Hadley, Spandau Ballet, Midge from Ultravox, Go West, they were all part of the same, Curiosity Killed the Cat, all part of the same 1987 Prince's Trust concert. And so among the giants like Eric Clapton, George Harrison, Elton John, there are some people who could be like a flash in the pan compared to some of those pillars of rock.
All right. Yeah.
In 1987, Boone Gould left the band to spend more time with his family. And he still wrote for the band after that, just didn't perform with them. His brother left shortly after, midway through the tour in December 1987, suffering from exhaustion and had again suffered a relationship issue with Mark King. They brought in Neil Conti to play drums for the rest of the tour.
Yeah. It seems like they had those moments with King often.
Yeah, it seems like that did come up a lot reading through the album, the discography, like on AllMusic and Wikipedia and stuff. They followed that album up with Staring at the Sun, 1988 album. They brought in Gary Husband as the full-time drummer, and Steve Topping became the guitarist. Topping and King didn't get along. And Steve Topping left the band after a short time. Most of the Staring at the Sun was done without a regular guitar player, as either Dominic Miller or Mark King playing an uncredited role. Alan Murphy was brought in near the end of the sessions, and they released the song Heaven in My Hands as a single from this, as well as the single Tracy. And I'm just realizing that there might be a couple songs in my playlist that are considered singles, considered greatest hit songs. That's we'll get to that.
It's okay, because really, frankly, it's level 42 and there's only one hit.
There's only one greatest hit.
Yeah, it's
right.
They're not embracing it like other people do. Again, I'm not going to mention who.
But
they're not embracing that they've got 1.5 greatest hits.
Right, right. All right. They recorded another live album that didn't get released for another 8 years, not until 1996. And Alan Murphy passed away before the release of the next album of complications from AIDS-related pneumonia. In October of 1989. 3 years went by, then they released the album Guaranteed from 1991. They signed a new contract with RCA, and Alan Holdsworth played some guitar on this album, like, for example, the song A Kinder Eye. The song was pretty well received in the US, but not so much in the UK. It did get to number 3 in the UK charts, which, compared to some of the previous albums, didn't seem as successful. And oh, well, there you go.
I think he just recently passed away.
Oh, interesting.
Hang on, I'm going to look. Yeah, he passed away on April 15th of this year.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow, just recently. Jeez. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, because I wouldn't say this album, The Guaranteed, had a yes feeling as much as it had a feeling like Nothing Like the Sun by Sting had a very... very similar feel to this album. And I don't know if there was a producer in common or if there was just an influence there, but for whatever reason, this album reminds me a lot of Nothing Like the Sun by Sting. And it might be, there's like an echoiness to the drums that I don't think they had before. That felt like we're in a big cavernous recording space. And that's kind of the effect of that. In 1994, again, another 3-year gap between albums, and we get Forever Now. Gary Husband left the band right before this album, and Phil Gould returned to his role as regular drummer. So his third tenure in the band. Danny Bloom played all guitars on the album, and Gavin Harrison took over drums later that year. We don't have it here, but I'm guessing maybe another dust up between Phil Gould and Mark King.
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah. Gavin Harrison also ended up playing for King Crimson and Porcupine Tree later on after Level 42.
Huge prog bands.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. And again, you know, these guys all could have so easily gone that route at the very beginning, right? I mean, if they wouldn't have gone into the pop arena, they easily could have, the scales could have dipped the other way and they could have gone into prog rock.
But I think one of the main reasons why they didn't was because the galloping bass line that seems prominent in every kind of thing, and there's not much galloping in prog.
Right, yeah.
And then two, I think a lot of it had to do with the King being King. Because I think they really could have drifted, because I think they would have had more variety and I think they would have had more dynamic sound if they'd drifted the other way. I think King took his kids and went home, kind of, in some ways.
Right. We're doing it this way. This is my band.
Yeah. And we find out later exactly how much that is.
Yes, exactly. Actually, very, very shortly here, you'll find that out. A couple years after the release of Forever Now, In 1996, Mark King released a solo single called Bitter Moon. and then he followed that with an album called One Man, which was not at all commercially successful. It'll surprise you not one bit that I own that album. And there's one good song on there I'll talk about later, but it's
is it Bitter? I know it's a different song, yeah, and a different album, but
no, well, I think Bitter Moon was included on there as well.
All right, yeah.
Yeah. In 2001, Mark King bought the rights to the name Level 42 and brought in a new lineup of members. Both past and previous members was announced, and they started doing shows again, concerts. In 2005, they did two shows, they saw two shows from the early 80s released finally on DVD. Basically, he at this point kind of becomes the... Ness of Social Distortion. Yeah, I mean, it's basically the...
It's Mark King and the Level 42s.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because you don't see you don't see Mike Lind up in the band anymore. You don't see the Goulds in the band, of course, anymore. So it's Mark King and whoever.
Yeah, it really is. Talk about flexing a muscle to get control.
Yeah, I think so. And, his argument is probably, well, the bass guitar is the most prominent thing, or my vocals are recognizable and therefore the name should stick with me kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. In 2006, they released the album Retroglide, which was recorded mostly at Mark King's home studio. Mike Lindup came back and sang, and as well as added keyboards, and even Boone Gould came back and co-wrote most of the album, as well as playing the guitar solo on the song Ship.
Look at the time, though, between when they were.
Will you be ready to sail with the tide?
Oh yeah, I mean 8 years, right? Staring at the sun. Oh no, they left after running the family. So 87, so almost 10 years. Or I'm sorry, almost 20, yeah. 20 years after that.
So maybe time helps people forget all wounds, or maybe they all heal, or maybe kind of like Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, they kept trying.
Sure. Yep, could be. Could be. They followed that up with a 20-date UK tour a couple years later in 2008. And then finally in 2013, we got a brand new 6-track studio EP from the band called Sirens.
Yeah.
And that's your Level 42. Do we know what they're doing now? What's Level 40? What's Level 42 doing now?
You know, they've got talent. Now, I have no idea. Know,
what's Mark King doing now, I should say?
He owns Level 42.
That's right. Let me take a look. They've got to still be touring. I think I still see ads for them touring in like Q Magazine and things. Let's see. Yeah, they played at the Rewind Festival, part of the Billboard Live Tour 2017. Really? Yep, they're playing. They were playing the Osaka leg of the Billboard Live Tour. And then a couple of videos of him talking about his equipment. Looks like even on the top of the page, you get a photo of the band. Definitely Mark King in the center there. And I think that is Mike Lindup to his right. Hmm. I wonder if he's still... Yeah, he's still listed as a member. And the rest of the members, Pete Ray Biggin, Sean Freeman, and Nathan King.
Hmm. Well, it's good to know they still can be Level 42s.
Yes, exactly. The Level 42s.
So there's not a lot of real statistics other than the fact that Something About You was a huge smash and then everything else happened afterwards.
Sure.
And then I guess the question, we've kind of danced around it, but is King really that hard to get along with or work with? Or was he just so focused that it kind of made him blind to others' feelings and opinions?
Well, you can be both. I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. I think that you've got musicians out there who are very talented and very focused, and it's that focus that makes them difficult to work with. I'm trying to think of a great example of that, like a performer who's known for being very meticulous.
I can think of one, but I don't know if it's, and he's very aware of it, and that's Steve Vai. He's worked in band settings, but he also knows that he's an incredible control freak and is better when he's working alone because he doesn't want to rub people the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I imagine Kanye is kind of like this. I mean, I think that he's probably very meticulous and very, you know, very specific about what he wants. Probably Madonna to some degree.
So here's a question for you. Could we do a soundography on Kanye? Could we do that? Are we strong enough to do that?
I think so. You mean, are we tough enough to listen to the entire
catalog
of Kanye? Axl Rose is a great example of that, by the way.
Oh, yeah, Axl Rose is a fantastic example of that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think we could at some point. My worry isn't so much that it'd be hard to get through his catalog, because I've listened to a lot of his music and actually I really enjoy it. I think it would be the fact that he doesn't fit into that known but not well known.
Yeah. Okay.
Field that we like to try.
Yeah.
And I'm glancing through like rock lists, like John Lydon, Johnny Rotten apparently is a little bit difficult to work with. Eddie Van Halen will even go so far as to tell the opening acts how to play their own songs.
from all reports, Phil Spector was hard to work with.
Right. Yep. Exactly.
Not a musician, but talented.
Yep. The Gallagher brothers are at least dicks to each other. I don't know if they're dicks to the rest of the band, but at least to each other.
Okay. They're... I thought you were talking about the pumpkin people, the watermelon guys again.
Oh, no, I'm talking about the guys from Oasis. Come on now. All right. Let's get to the concert. And you're lucky enough to be seeing Level 42 in concert. What are the songs that you're going to make sure that they have to do, right? And I threw some of these in here.
Hot Water. I only had one.
You only had one. Hot Water, Love Games. I think Love Games because it was their first big breakthrough single. And then of course, Lessons in Love and Running in the Family. But come on. I mean, if there's any song that you're going to be disappointed that they don't play in concert, there's only one you really can choose from, and it's Something About You.
And they're probably playing that like Tone Loc does. I mean, opening
at the beginning,
mid show, pre encore and encore.
All right, well, prepare to have your mind blown, Hammond. Hot Water is their most played song.
Really?
Yes, that is number one. Something About You doesn't even show up until number four in the list.
That's because Mark King's being spiteful.
He is. He's like, you want to hear Something About You? Well, blow off. Piss off. Sun Goes Down, Living It Up. That, again, one of those first big singles. So probably got a lot of play in those years between 1981 and 1985 before Something About You hit. But Lessons in Love also in that top. So a song that came out after Something About You that is played marginally more than...
That really does seem spiteful to me. I'm sorry.
Come on now, really?
Yeah,
it seems that he does that just to be mean?
I'm thinking if you go to a show and they don't play Something About You, he's being a jerk.
Oh, Hammond, that's so...
that's like going to Ricky Ashley concert and not having him do Never Gonna Give You Up.
Right, right. I don't know, man. I think it's funny. It is very funny. Let's see. Looks like they opened for Madonna for a while during the Who's That Girl tour, and they played their set list was The Chinese Way, To Be With You Again, Micro Kid, The Chant Has Begun, World Machine, Sun Goes Down, Living It Up, Children Say, Running the Family, Physical Presence, Lessons in Love, Fashion Fever. Then they probably leave the stage until the encore comes out, and then they come back and do Something About You, followed by It's Over. So that's their... You're probably going to say that's Mark King being a dick, aren't
no,
you?
No, I mean, no, he played it. they played it.
Yeah. They did play it. And, you know, that is a thing you do for your encore. That is the, you know, if you have a monster hit, that is the one you use for your encore.
Yeah. You open with the new single.
Right. Yep.
Then you close with the song you're going to release next. Like yes. The next single, and then you do the encore with your big hit.
Or you close with a song that really features everybody in the band kind of doing their thing. Yes. Like, like, oh, everybody gets a solo in this song, yep. Or, you know?
Yeah. But there's a structure you're supposed to have, and playing Something About You in the encore totally makes sense.
Right.
But not playing it at all when you do certain shows, that's you saying to your fans, oh, by the way, we know you love the song and we're not going to play it.
That's right. We're keeping you, dangling you on the hook until we,
and I bet you they even start.
Oh, God. And then they go into something else.
Yeah. Like that, there's that song from Guaranteed.
All right. The Eagles. Do you think they close their set with, their main set with Seven Bridges Road and then begin their encores with, Hotel California?
I actually think they do. They've got so many hits though. See, this is,
yeah, but Hotel California is like the
one. That's their
Stairway to Heaven.
So I would say that either they do it after the first break, cause you know how some bands take play for a while and then they come back and after the drum solo, I think they do it right after that, or they do it as the first song in the encore.
Right. Oh yeah, maybe. Too funny. All right, let's get to our playlist. This is where we pick songs that usually aren't on the greatest hits albums. Give you a set of songs to combine with the greatest hits to make a fun playlist, or in this case, Hammond would say the greatest hit.
Yeah. Well, so, and here's the thing, Brian, I might just have you just do all 10 because, for me, I was just at the end, I'm just like, this is a song. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, you really didn't enjoy this one.
It was good. I'm being a little bit over dramatic on this, but
I know you're having fun with it.
It was definitely, after 1991.
Yeah. Yes.
It was definitely a little bit of a pace changer.
I would agree. Yep. Yeah, totally. I think that the absence of a lot of those other members really showed when you started losing the Gould brothers, when you started losing even Mike Lindup's involvement at parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a little bit difficult. All right. Here's my five songs, starting with not just one of my favorite Level 42 songs, but one of my favorite songs, period. And it's the song To Be With You Again. From the Running in the Family album. Yeah, I know. Again, this is probably included in their greatest hits, but it is, there is so much to this. It's absolutely layers and layers of production. And, it's just, I just can't, when it comes up on shuffle, I can't help but sing along at the top of my lungs with it. It's one of my favorite tunes, as I keep mentioning. The next one again, and then I'll get off of the greatest hits, but Tracy, which came from the Staring at the Sun.
Yeah.
This almost feels like it could have been. We had a song a while back that we said could have been a Men at Work song. This is another one that feels like it could have been Colin Hay singing vocals on it.
Yeah.
The song Tracy. We're going far back for my third track, which is from the Pursuit of Accidents album, You Can't Blame Lewis.
Then he ran into a problem. He heard a voice inside him say, do you believe that what you have is what you need? You can't blame Lewis.
It's got a kind of a fun story that it tells, and it's just a weird chorus that, yeah, you can't blame Lewis. And it repeats, oh, Lewis, you can't blame Lewis.
It kind of reminds me, when I heard it, kind of reminds me of something that Ben Folds would have done.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I didn't even think about that. Totally true. We'll go to the World Machine album for my number four track, which is I Sleep on My Heart. Song with Mike Lindup vocals, very prominent Mike Lindup vocals, and it's fun and it's upbeat, and it's in that, still in that range where they've got a little bit of jazz and a lot of funk still involved in their music. My number five is from the Guaranteed album, which largely I felt was a fairly weak album. I'm you know, Retroglide is aural wallpaper for sure. Guaranteed is when they started to slide into that role of aural wallpaper. I'm saying that very carefully so people know it's spelled with an A, U, not with an O. But Lasso the Moon is, I think, next to last song on the album, and it's all Mike Lindup vocals. And I'm going to bet that it's written by Mike Lindup as well, not just the music, but I'll bet he took on writing lyrics. And if ever there was a song that deserved to have like a Disney Pocahontas X-esque animated music video for it, it's Lasso the Moon. It's
actually
a really pretty story.
When you said animated video, my first thought was a Ghibli studio version.
Oh, totally. Yes. Right. Oh, that'd be so good. Yeah. That'd be awesome. Wish I had talent for that sort of thing. Cause there's a bunch of songs like that I'd love to create music videos for.
You know who do it though? You know who actually the style that would match right now?
Who's that?
Carter Johnson.
Oh, Carter would do great with something like that. Yeah. No kidding. There's a thought. Maybe I'll see if there's any interest there. I could do the keyframes, but like I could do like a little
storyboard
animatics. Right, exactly. Yeah. So here's kind of what I'm thinking. And then I'm going to throw a bonus in here from not one of the Level 42 albums, but from that Mark King solo one man album. That's a song called Pamela.
Giving it a box. Talk and stalk the locker room. Cause his weenie isn't blooming. He knows something.
And of all the songs on that album, it's the only one that's actually fun to listen to. It doesn't feel like a dirge. It's really funny. It's a song about plastic surgery, and it's got lyrics, you know, talking about a swinging thing and like not just female plastic surgery, but male plastic surgery and male enhancement and female stuff going on. The lyrics are actually really, really funny. And I think that the reference is to Pamela Anderson, because they talk about, have you got the surgeon's number for Pamela? And I'm guessing it's because everybody wants to look like Pamela Anderson. And boy, that probably dates it too, right there, right?
Because
that was 1989 or 90 or whenever it was that they released that. No, it was 96.
It still fits.
Still totally fits. So there's my six songs.
All right. So I picked Model Friend from Forever Now. It's a kind of a nice take on the reggae rhythm.
Yep. Tina really liked that. When we were listening to this, Tina perked up at that one a lot.
Yeah, it sounds different from the rest of the stuff on that I'd heard. And
yeah,
when there is a nice kind of, not quite ska, but there's a definite kind of upbeat feel to this one that I really enjoyed. Then I picked The Ape from Guaranteed. There's something unique about the vocals and the way the song kind of feels. Again, most of it was just kind of music whitewashed onto air, but this one did stand out, and I did like it, so. Retro Glide, the title track. This song seems to do nothing that I expected them to do with this song. In a city full of dreamers, it's as good as it gets. Oh, go tell the spider to text the eggs. This comic book paper is 9 to 5, 7 or 11, and it's so bad in a city. I kind of expected them to turn left and they turned right, and I expected them to go up and they went down, and it kind of kept me on the edge of my seat, which was interesting for a band that had gotten to a point, by the time I'd been listening to this in chronological order, I felt like I knew exactly what I was going to get by the time I heard this title track, and
right.
This kind of caught me off guard, so I enjoyed it just because it was a shift. And then looks like Brian's second bonus track is Freedom Someday from Running in the Family. I'm not chasing miracles. I don't want no sympathy. I'm waiting for the world to keep me company.
I'm so glad you chose this one, because I love this song.
Well, tell why you do, and then I'll say why I picked it.
It is, I mean, boy, you look at the dictionary under the word jaunty, and you find a reference to this song, Freedom Sound. It's such a jaunty song, and it's funny because this was back when I was buying albums and maybe getting the occasional CD, right? And the Running in the Family album came out, and had all these great songs on it. And then it wasn't late until I found out later that if you bought the CD version, you got one bonus track, which was Freedom Someday. And it's like, oh, this is, I think, my favorite song from the album at the time. And totally loved it. And it was a bummer that it was only included on the CD. Like, it was an afterthought. Like, well, I guess we've got a little extra room. Should we throw that Freedom Someday song on there? And
yeah, I liked it just because you're right. It is fun. It is jaunty. It is one of the more upbeat songs in their entire catalog.
Yeah, it really bounces, and it's so focused. It's so focused on keyboards. It's not at all focused on bass. It seems like a lot of the stuff from, I'd say, 83 until 91 is, here's the bass line I really like playing. Build a song around that.
Yep.
And that one doesn't feel like it at all. It feels like it's Wally Badaroo was saying, all right, we're going to do these chords, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. And then Brian's third bonus track is I Don't Know Why from Staring at the Sun.
I'm Yeah, and it's funny because of all the stuff I just said about Freedom Someday, I'm going to totally flip it to talk about this one. But it's got such a great bass line to it. I really like that. But
yeah,
it does go against everything I just said about Freedom Someday, which is keyboard focused.
But I do like this one too, because there's a variance to it. And when you're binge listening to an entire catalog like we do, I don't know how you approach it, but when I hear something that's different from the rest of the pile, I perk up and listen to it, because if it's different, it's worth listening. I mean, something's changed.
Oh, yes.
And so when I hear something that makes me listen to something after, 3 hours of binge listening, then you write it down as something that's worth going back to. And you when totally I went back to this, it was worth putting on the list.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt.
It's not no doubt. It's level 42.
It doesn't always apply though. Like, you can't always say anytime there's something different.
No,
there's a song on Retroglide called Helltown Story, I think it is. And it sounds like muffled vocals coming through a staticky radio.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And boy, I mean,
but I listened to it, but I didn't, I mean, it was different enough that I stopped to listen.
Right, it did
wasn't
catch your ear.
Good enough for me to say anything about.
Exactly.
Well, it's like the ZZ Top. When we did ZZ Top, you picked that one song that sounds so unlike a ZZ Top song.
Oh, yeah, right.
And we've all kind of, as we've done this, we've both gone through and picked songs that are kind of atypical, because they do stand out by being atypical.
Yes, right. Nope, that is so, you've nailed it. Absolutely. Very good. Well, that you put all those songs together and couple it with their greatest hits album.
Do they have a greatest hits album?
Oh my God, dude. And I know you're joking when you say that, because when you go to, when you look for level 42 on Apple Music, you find dozens of, like, the guys only have 13 studio albums, right? Or maybe 14 studio albums. But there is so much crap that I'm guessing that Mark King licensed out and said, oh, sure, you want to put our song on this album? That's totally fine.
Yep.
And it's all these really crappy album cover designs with Comic Sans or whatever BS they...
My favorite's Lessons in Love from the Level 42s.
See that right here? Oh my God. And it's exactly what you're talking about. But there's one set, like a bunch of albums that all seem to have the same font.
And it's, there's like Something About You and More Hits from Level 42. And it's got three songs listed on the cover.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, it's oh my God. You just look through all these.
Then Sensational, really, Level 42.
The Level 42 hits. anyway, so there you go. When you're looking for Level 42, that's what you'll find when you look, like, for example, on Apple Music. Probably the same thing when you look for them on Spotify and Pandora.
It might be worth hooking them up with the Hits Live. That might be where you go.
Hits Live, the tour that's got like...
The 2009, it says Level 42, the Hits.
Oh, I think Level Best is the one you send them to.
Okay. All right. That's fine.
That's a good one. Okay. It doesn't have anything post Staring at the Sun, but I think that's okay. I think that's all right.
As long as it has Something About You and Running in the Family, I think it's okay.
Believe it or not, it has both of those. All right. Okay. Done. You've made your point. all right, so let's talk about our next episode of Soundography. I was distracted because I'm looking through to make sure I get the name right. I want to make sure I pronounce this right. So this is one of our sponsored shows. When you join up with Patreon, one of the levels you can donate at, pledge at, allows you to pick the artist that we cover for an entire episode. And that's our next episode. It's going to be Thomas Kalnacki, who's probably best known for Streetlight Manifesto, although, again, he's been member of GIMP and Tokay and which I think is like a solo project, Bandits of the Acoustic Revolution, Catch 22, etc. And we're going to be going through all of that stuff as part of this. I said Bandits of the Acoustic Revolution, but I said it like it's two separate bands. Bandits of the Acoustic Revolution, all one name. Anyway, big thanks to our supporter who did that. And you're going to get to hear not the patron that purchased it, but his wife, who the patronage was a gift for. And this episode is going to be a gift for us. So big thanks to Daniel for supporting the show. And what a great gift to give this to his wife.
I also want to give a shout out to, let's see, is it Jim in Canada? Yes, Jim from Canada. He mm-hmm. sent us a very nice, well, long and detailed email as he was listening to the New Order show.
Oh, cool.
Kind of breaking down all the things that either were missed or not exactly accurate or mm-hmm. that he was trying to emphasize. And it's greatly appreciated. And it was a fun read through. And the fact that he did it while he was listening through the episode, just it the fact that he spent that much time with us is amazing.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, totally.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim, for doing that.
Absolutely. And you know, you might be hesitant to send in stuff like that because you're worried that we're going to get offended if you tell us corrections to things that we get wrong. Not at all. As a matter of fact, you know, we delve through an entire band's catalog in, we say 7 days. For me, it's about 3 days because of my Coverville production schedule. So I listen to an entire catalog for a band in 3 days or 3 or 4 days sometimes. And there are going to be times that we do get stuff wrong. And we know it. We've accepted it.
Yep. In fact, in some ways, I think we kind of count on it because if we don't count on it, then it's, you know, it's just the way things go. I mean,
yes.
I do the notes on like Wednesday if I'm lucky, and it's just kind of pounding through. Some bands we're more familiar with, and other bands we jump in cold, like Brian, New Level 42. I went in with something about you.
Yeah,
right. And I'm exactly. leaving with something about you.
Okay, all right, fine. Poor Mark King, kick him when he's down.
He can take it.
He totally can take it for sure. Excellent. So that is our next episode. Again, Streetlight Manifesto and Thomas Kalnacki and all of his other Tomas Kalnacki and all of his other projects, everything that he does. So look for that one coming up very shortly. But that's going to do it. If you want to get in touch with us, please do. We'd love to get your comments, your emails, your suggestions, your ideas. You can email us at soundographypodcast@gmail.com. You can visit us on Twitter @TheSoundography and let us know your 140 character or less thoughts on everything that we say. Everything else, go to soundography.com. It's our website where you can download previous shows. You can look at the show notes. You can check out the links we provide to our playlist via Spotify, as well as our Amazon link where you can buy the music we link to. Check out Level Best by Level 42 in the links for this one. And of course, that Amazon link gives us a kickback. So if you use that, we get a little money back. Even if you don't buy what we link to, as long as you use that as the starting point and then add stuff to your cart after that, then we get a little bit of a kickback, and that comes in very, very handy. Check out our playlist on Spotify for this song, or for this, for for our additional songs. And become a patron, like we talked about. You can pick your own subject for an episode of Soundography, and we will do it. We will listen to whatever you tell us to listen to, for Pete's sake. Find out more about that by going to patreon.com/soundography. Anything else, Hammond? Have we covered this?
I think we're good. I think we've climbed all 42 levels, and it's time to jump off.
Okay. All right. That is going to do it for us. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, for Hammond Chamberlain, this is Brian Abbott saying bye now, and thanks for listening to Soundography.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.